Her breath caught when his thumb brushed across her lips. He asked, "Do you want me to stop?" "I want you to do that with your mouth." He gently pressed his lips to hers. Sarah kissed him back. There was no passion, just the overwhelming need for reconnection. Will pulled her close. Sarah buried her face in the crook of his neck. She wrapped her arms around his waist. She felt him relax into her. They clung to each other, standing outside the open door to her apartment, until her cell phone chimed. Then chimed again. And again. Will broke away first. Reluctantly, Sarah picked up her purse from the floor. They both knew that Amanda sent rapid-fire texts, just as they both knew there was only one reason she would be reaching out to Sarah after 8 o'clock at night. She found her phone. She swiped her finger across the screen. "Amanda, need you now, Angie's car found, 1885 Somerset. Amanda, cadaver dog found scent in trunk. Amanda, don't tell Will." Sarah told him. Chapter 8. Will sat beside Sarah in her BMW. She was being strong for him. Silent, but strong. They hadn't talked about more than logistics since she'd read Amanda's texts. "Do you know where this is? Do you want me to drive?" Sarah turned onto Spring Street. Night had fallen. The instrument panel cast her face in white tones. Will gripped her hand as tightly as he could without breaking something. He still felt numb, except for the places where he didn't. There was an elephant standing on his chest. The pain was physical, suffocating. His arm hurt. Or maybe it only hurt because Faith had asked him before if his arm was hurting. Or maybe he was unraveling, because that was what everyone kept saying he was going to do. Cadaver dogs were trained to find the scent of decomposition. They had alerted on Angie's trunk. That meant that everyone was thinking that Angie was dead. Was it true? Was Angie dead? The most important person in his life for 30 years. Angie had been the only person in his life for 30 years. That was the only incontrovertible fact. Will tried to summon that moment in the basement. All those years ago, when Angie had held him, comforted him. Nothing. He tried to remember the one time they went on a vacation together. They had argued about directions. They had argued about where to eat. They had argued about who was being more argumentative. "You dumbass," was the last thing she'd said to him that night, and the next morning she was gone. Angie was awful to live with. She was constantly breaking things, borrowing things, never putting his stuff back where it belonged. Will's mind strained for one single good memory. But all he saw was static. The fuzzy white and black patches that used to show on TV when the station went off the air. Sarah squeezed his hand. He looked down at their intertwined fingers. One of the first things he'd noticed about Sarah was how long and graceful her fingers were. He didn't know if that came with being a surgeon, or it was simply because everything about her was beautiful. He studied her face, her sharp chin, her button nose, her long auburn hair that was pinned up into a swirl at the back of her head. She usually took her hair down after work. Will knew this was for his sake, that it drove her crazy when her hair fell into her eyes. She was constantly pushing it back, and he never told her to pin it up, because he was selfish. Every relationship, romantic or otherwise, had a certain level of selfishness. It went back and forth, depending on who was stronger or who needed it most. Amanda sucked up selfishness like a sponge. Faith gave it away too easily. Angie reached down your throat and grabbed it and then kicked you in the balls for thinking you could have it in the first place. Will had always thought that he and Sarah shared an emotional equivalence. but was Will taking all the selfishness for himself? He had lied to her about what had happened with Angie last Saturday. He had lied to her about the letter Angie had left for him in the post office box. He had lied about his and Angie's joint banking account. He had lied about not doing everything he could do to find her. Angie. She was dead now. Maybe. Most likely. He would have a clean slate. For the first time in 30 years, Will's confidant, his torturer, his source of support and source of pain, was gone. He shivered. Sarah turned on the air conditioner. Are you okay? Yes. He looked out the window so she could not see his face. The elephant shifted its weight. Will could almost feel his ribs flex from the pressure. His vision strobed. He opened his mouth and tried to fill his lungs. They were in Midtown. The bright lights outside the window hurt his eyes. His ears buzzed with the fan blowing out cold air from the dash. Underneath the sound, there was music. Soft women's voices harmonizing over a steel guitar. Sarah never turned off the radio. She only turned the volume down low. She released his hand so that she could put on the blinker. They were at 1885 Somerset. Instead of a building, there was a house, a sprawling English Tudor that took up half a city block. The lawn sloped toward the street. Neatly trimmed grass and well-manicured flowers led up to stone steps. Angie's car had been found at a funeral home. Sarah pulled into the parking lot. An old pickup truck with a yellow lab in the passenger seat was leaving the scene. A patrol car was parked on the grass. The officer was sitting behind the wheel, typing into the laptop mounted onto the dash. Will recognized Amanda Suburban and Faith's red Mini. Charlie Reed was there in his white crime scene van, but for some reason he was sitting behind the wheel instead of processing Angie's car. The black Dodge Charger belonged to Collier and Ng. The GBI was still in charge, but Angie's car had been found in the Atlanta city limits, and there was still an active murder investigation. The two detectives were sitting on the hood the same as they'd been this morning. Ng still had on his wraparound sunglasses. He did the chin-nod thing when Will got out of the car. Collier waved, but Amanda must have put them under strict orders to keep their distance because neither of them approached. Angie's Monte Carlo SS was parked in a handicapped space in front of the building. She would park in a handicapped space because that's what she did. Yellow crime scene tape roped off the area. The trunk was open. The driver's door was open. Even from 20 yards, Will could smell the sickly sweet odor of death. Or maybe it was like his arm hurting. He only smelled death because someone had planted the idea in his mind. Amanda came out of a side door. Unusually, her BlackBerry wasn't in her hand. She had a lot of things she could yell at Will about right now, but she didn't.
Uniform patrol spotted Angie's car an hour ago. The funeral home closed at 6, but there's an intern who sleeps here for overnight calls.
An intern? Will tried to ask the question that a cop would.
From the local mortuary school. Amanda crossed her arms. He was picking up a body at a nursing home when the uni found Angie's car. Faith is talking to him in the chapel.
Will studied the house. He guessed the large two-story structure at the end was the chapel. Amanda said,
"The uni smelled an odor. He popped the trunk, using the latch inside the car. He called in the cadaver dog. It hit on the scent immediately."
Will looked at the car again. Parked at an angle. Hastily abandoned. The windows were down. His vision flashed up an image. Angie slumped over the wheel. He blinked, and it was gone. "Will," Sarah said. He looked at her. "Why are you rubbing your chest?" Will hadn't realized he was rubbing his chest. He stopped. He told Amanda,
"There are license plate scanners on Spring and Peachtree."
She nodded. Scanners all over the city tracked the movement of traffic and searched for the license plates of stolen or suspect vehicles.
"The data is being sent to the computer division for analysis." Will looked out at the street. Somerset and Spring was a busy corner. Midtown was heavily monitored. Every major intersection had a camera. Amanda said, "We've requested footage from GDOT and APD. We'll comb through it as soon as it's in hand. Search teams are on the way." Will said what she already knew. Someone left the car here. They would need to drive away, or... "I've got everybody in the state looking for Delilah Palmer." Will had forgotten about Dale Harding's wife, or daughter, or both. Palmer was a young prostitute with a drug problem. She had grown up in the system. The only parent she'd ever known had exploited her. She could have been Angie 20 years ago, except that Angie had managed to pull herself out, or at least make it seem that way. Will wasn't so sure she had managed to escape anything. Sarah's hand pressed against the small of his back. "You okay?" Will walked toward the car. The smell grew more pungent as he got closer. You didn't need a bloodhound to know that something bad had happened here. He stopped at the crime scene tape. The trunk of Angie's car was lined with a scratchy, charcoal-colored carpet that he'd gotten from a roll at Pep Boys. He had leaned over the trunk for hours, lining up the seams, gluing it in place. Amanda shined a police-issue mag light into the trunk. There was only a dark stain in the carpet, just a little off from the center. The only thing in the trunk was a red plastic bottle of transmission fluid. Will knelt down. He examined the pavement under the car. The transmission was leaking. The car was probably his now. He would have to fix it before he sold it. "Will?" Sarah put her hand on his shoulder. She knelt beside him. "Look at me." He looked at her. "I think we should go. There's nothing here." Will stood up, but he didn't go. He went to the driver's side of the car. The door was wide open. A half-empty bottle of tequila was in the footwell. A joint was in the ashtray. Candy wrappers. Gum. Angie had a sweet tooth. He asked Amanda, "It was like this when the uni rolled up?" She nodded. The open door would act like a flag to whoever drove by, which meant the car was left to be found sooner rather than later. Will took the flashlight from Amanda. He shined the light into the car. The interior was light gray. The shift for the manual transmission jutted out from the floor between the seats. He saw blood on the steering wheel, blood on the driver's seat, blood on the white circle on top of the black shifter knob. It was an 8-ball. Angie had picked it out of a magazine. This was before the internet. Will had gone to 3 different stores to find an adapter so it would screw onto the stick. He turned the flashlight, examining the back seat. More blood, almost black from baking in the sun all day. There was a smear near the door handle, too small for a handprint. Maybe a closed fist punching out. Maybe a desperate last move to get away. Someone had lain bleeding in the back seat. Someone had lain bleeding in the trunk. Someone had been bleeding or covered in blood when they drove the car away. He asked Amanda, "Two bodies and the driver?" Amanda had obviously considered this. "She could have been moved from the back seat to the trunk." "Still bleeding?" he asked, meaning still alive. "Gravity," Sarah said. "If there was a chest wound and she was on her side, depending on how she was positioned, you might expect that amount of blood to seep out post-mortem." "She," Will said. "What about Delilah Palmer?" "I had someone at Grady run down her blood type. She had an admit for an OD last year. She's O positive. Angie was B negative." Amanda's hand was on his arm. She had tried to let him work this out on his own, leaving Charlie in his van, calling off Collier and Ing, but now she was going to give him the truth. "Wilbur, I know this is hard to hear, but everything points toward Angie." She laid it out for him. "Angie's blood type was all over the crime scene. We found her purse, her gun. This is her car. Charlie already typed the blood for me, The back seat, the trunk, and the front seat are all B negative. We've got the DNA on Rush, but given the rarity of the blood type, the likelihood that it's not Angie is slim to none. And it's a hell of a lot of blood, Will. Too much blood for her to walk away.
Will mulled over her words. The stain in the trunk was in the area you would expect from a chest wound. Arterial spray was found on the walls of the room where Dale Harding died. Arteries were in the heart. The heart was in the chest. Will tried to play out a likely scenario. Angie in the back seat, bleeding to death. The driver, some guy she'd called because she always had a guy she could call. He would be desperately trying to get her help, and then he would realize that it was too late. And then he would put her in the trunk because he couldn't drive around the city with a dead woman in the back seat of the car. And then he would wait until sundown and drive the car here. The manager is on the way. Faith came walking down a lighted path. An open spiral notebook was in her hand. She looked at Will, then looked at him again. Amanda said, "And?" Faith referenced her notes. "Inside we've got Ray Belcamino, 20-year-old male Caucasian, no record, mortuary student at Gupton Jones. He clocked into work at approximately 5:15 for a 5:30 shift. His call-in sheet has him three times off the premises, once to Piedmont Hospital at 6:43, another to Sunrise Nursing Home at 7:02, and a third, a false alarm, at 8:22. She looked up. "Apparently it's a thing for interns to call in fake deaths to prank each other."
"Of course it is," Amanda said.
All three times Belcamino used the commercial entrance near the chapel, behind the fence. There's a service elevator that goes down to the basement. He can't see the parking lot over the fence. He drove in from the west each time, so he didn't pass the parking lot and he didn't see the car. Amanda asked,
"Closed-circuit cameras?"
"Six, but they're all trained on the doors and windows, not the parking lot." Will asked,
"Did you check the dumpster?"
"First thing, nothing."
He asked, "Were any of the doors tampered with?"
"No, and there's an alarm system. Every door and window is wired."
"How is the elevator accessed?"
"There's a keypad."
Will asked, "Can the keypad be seen from behind the fence?"
"Yeah, and it turns off the alarm, too." Amanda asked,
"Where are you going with this?"
"Why bring a car that has a dead body in a trunk to a funeral home?" They all looked back at the building. Faith said, "I'll go. Wait here." Will didn't wait. He didn't run, either, but his stride was twice as long as Faith's. He reached the chapel before she did. He opened the door before she did. He passed the pews and walked onto the stage and found the door that led to the back half of the funeral home before she did. Behind the scenes was scuffed and utilitarian. Drop ceiling, peeling linoleum. There was a long hallway running the entire back of the building. Two massive elevator doors stood sentry at one end. Will knew that there was likely an identical set of elevator doors to the outside, and that this was where the bodies were transported down to the basement. He headed toward the elevator, assuming there would be stairs. Faith was right behind him. She was jogging to catch up, so Will started jogging so that she couldn't. The metal stairs were old and jangly. His footsteps jarred the railing. At the bottom, there was a landing with a swinging door. Will pushed through to a small office, more like a vestibule. There was another set of double doors behind a wooden desk, and at the desk sat a young man who could only be Ray Belcamino. The kid jumped up. His iPad clattered to the floor. Will tried the double doors, locked, no windows.
"How many bodies do you have in here?"
Belcamino's eyes darted to Faith as she came through the swinging door. She was out of breath.
"I need your logs. We have to match each body to a name."
The kid looked panicked.
"Is one missing?"
Will wanted to grab him by the collar.
"We need a body count."
"Seven?" he said. "No, eight. Eight."
He picked up the iPad. He started tapping the screen.
"The two tonight, three more from this week, one being processed, two awaiting cremation." Faith grabbed the iPad. She glanced through the list. She told Will, "I don't recognize any of the names."
"What names?"
Bel Camino had started to sweat. He either knew something or suspected something.
"What's wrong?"
Will pushed him back against the wall.
"Who are you working with?"
"Nobody!" Panic cracked his voice.
"Here! I work here!"
The swinging door banged open. Amanda, then Sarah, then Charlie crammed into the small vestibule. Amanda asked Bel Camino,
"Where do you store the bodies?"
"There's a buzzer."
His eyes darted toward the desk. Will let him go. The kid reached underneath the desk and found the button. The rear set of doors arced open. Light green tiled walls. Dark green linoleum floor. Chemical smells. Bright lights, low ceiling. About the size of a school classroom. There was a body at the front of the room, elderly man, wrinkled skin, white tufts of hair. A cloth covered his genitals. Tubes went out of his neck and connected him to a machine with a canister. The walk-in freezer was in the back, large stainless steel door, reinforced glass window. Amanda was already there. Her hand hovered over a green, lighted button to open the door. Will traversed the room. This was the second time today he'd walked toward an unknown, thinking that he was going to find Angie's body. His vision sharpened. His ears picked up every sound. The freezer door made a heavy clicking sound. Cold air seeped out from around the edges. An automatic arm opened the door at a glacial pace. Will had worked in a grocery store once. The walk-in, where they kept the frozen foods, was not dissimilar. Shelves on each side. 6 tiers evenly spaced floor to ceiling. About 15 feet deep, maybe 10 feet high. Instead of bags of peas on the shelves, there were black body bags. 4 on one side, 4 on the other.
"Fuck me."
Bel Camino ripped a clipboard off the wall. He ran into the freezer. He checked the labels on the bags against the list. He was on the last body when he stopped.
"There's no tag."
Will started to go inside. Sarah caught him by the wrist. "You know you can't be the one to find her." He had found her. He had figured out why the car was at the funeral home. He had led them into the basement. He couldn't stop now. The bag was less than 10 feet away. The shelves were tight. Angie's nose would be less than half a foot from the corpse above her. She was claustrophobic. She was terrified of tight spaces. "Will," Sarah's hand moved to his arm, "you need to let them take care of her, okay? Let Charlie do his job. He has to take photographs. The bag needs to be preserved for fingerprints. There could be trace evidence on the floor. We have to do this the right way or we'll never be able to find out why she was left here." He knew all of this was true, but he couldn't move. "Come on." She pulled at his arm. He stepped back, then back again. Charlie opened his duffel. He slipped on a pair of shoe protectors, then gloves. He put a fresh card in his camera. He checked the batteries, confirmed the date and time. He started outside the freezer, slowly working his way in. He photographed the bag from every angle, kneeling down, leaning over the other bodies. He used his ruler for scale. He left marked cards on items of interest. It felt like an hour had passed before he finally told Ray Bel Camino, "Get a gurney. The space is too tight. We'll need to move her so we can open the bag." Bel Camino disappeared into another room. He returned with a gurney. A white sheet was folded on the center. He kicked the wheel straight and forced the gurney up the small ramp that led to the freezer. Charlie handed him a pair of gloves. Obviously, moving bodies was a job that Bel Camino had done on his own before. He muscled the black bag onto the gurney like he was moving a rolled carpet. Will had to look away because he was going to hit the kid if he had to watch him a second longer. He heard the gurney being rolled out, the freezer door shutting with a thunk. Amanda said,
"Thank you, Mr. Bel Camino. You can wait upstairs."
Bel Camino offered no protest as he left the room. Charlie took more photographs. He dragged over a step stool that was against the wall. He stood over the bag and took more photos.
He used the ruler again to document scale. Will stared at the contours of the black bag. He couldn't make sense of what was underneath. And then he realized that the body was on its side, that whoever had taken it from the trunk had left it in the same position in which it had died. Angie always slept on her side, close to him but not touching him. Sometimes at night, her breath would tickle his ear and he would have to turn over so that he could go to sleep.
Faith?
Charlie held out an extra pair of gloves. The fingers dangled in the air for a second before Faith finally took them. Her hands were obviously sweating. She struggled to pull on the gloves. Her jaw was clamped tight. She hated dead bodies. She hated being in the morgue. She hated autopsies. She grabbed the zipper and started to pull. The sound was like a rip. Something tearing apart. Something breaking. The body was turned away from them. Will saw dark hair. Brown, the same color as Angie's. The woman's bare shoulder was revealed. The curve of her spine. The arc of her hip. Her legs were bent. Her hands were between her knees. Her toes were curled. The feet sickled. Faith gagged. The smell was noxious. Putrid. The body had been in the trunk for hours in the broiling sun. Heat had accelerated the decomposition. The skin was desiccated. The human body was made up of the same fiber and tissue as any other mammal. Both had the same reaction to heat, which was to release fluids. Charlie spread open the bag. A trickle of blood turned pink by cholesterol splattered onto the floor. Faith gagged again. She put the back of her hand under her nose. She squeezed her eyes closed. She was standing on the opposite side of the gurney. She had seen the face. She shook her head.
I can't tell if it's her. She's just...
beaten, Charlie said. Will looked at her back, blackened with patches that looked like soot. The same pattern was on her legs, on the soles of her feet. Bleach, Sarah said. The odor steamed off the bag. She wasn't scrubbed clean, though. It looks like the bleach was poured, almost sloshed.
Her clothes are gone, Amanda noted. Someone was worried about trace evidence.
Faith said, she was somewhere other than the car.
Her face looks like someone took a bat to her.
Charlie did a cursory examination.
Contusions and lacerations on the face and neck, fingernail scrapes. It looks like bones were broken.
He knelt down with the camera, zooming in on the head, neck, chest, torso.
Multiple stab wounds.
He asked Will,
does she have any identifying marks? Tattoos?
Will shook his head. Then he remembered. Time moved in double frame, as if someone had pressed the fast forward on his life. Will was pulling away from Sarah. He was walking around the gurney. He was pushing Charlie aside. He was looking at the body. The deep black bruises, the cuts, the mottled skin. And there it was. A single mole on her breast. Was it in the same place? Why couldn't he remember where the mole was supposed to be? He found himself on his knees. He looked at her face. Bloated. Unrecognizable. Her head was swollen to twice its size. Black and red marks crisscrossing her face. Her lips were leaking fluid. Her nose was twisted to the side. More like a Halloween mask than a face. Was it Angie? Did it feel like Angie? The numbness inside of Will had never really gone away. He felt nothing looking at this woman. He noticed the things he would notice on any case. Domestic homicide, battery, assault, mouth open, teeth broken, lips chapped and swollen like too ripe fruit. Her eyelids were thick, the consistency of wet bread. Blue veins and red arteries shot through almost translucent skin. Her cheek had been sliced with a very sharp knife or a razor, the skin flapped back, hanging open like a page in a book. He saw tissue, sinew, stark white of bone. He looked at her hands. They were balled together between her bent knees. The heat had curled her fingers. Decomposition had cracked open the skin. Clear liquid seeped out from the joints of her knuckles. The ring around her finger had broken apart. Angie's wedding ring. Green plastic with a bright yellow sunflower. Will had wasted 3/4 on a bubblegum machine before the ring had come out. The dare had been that Angie would marry him if it took less than 4/4. She never backed down from a dare. She had married him. She had lasted 10 days before he came home from work and found that all of her clothes were gone. Will opened his mouth. He breathed in and out. Amanda asked,
"Will?"
Will shook his head. This wasn't right. Someone had planted the ring. He would know instinctively if this was Angie. He stood up. He said,
"It's not her."
Faith asked, "What about the ring?" Will kept shaking his head. More looks were being exchanged. They clearly thought he was in denial, but they were wrong. Maybe when he was outside looking at the bloodied car, hearing Amanda run down the evidence, he had let himself think it might be Angie. But now that he was in the same room with this body, this stranger, he was certain that she was still alive. It was what Sarah said. He did not feel the hollowness. He did not feel an absence of the heart. Charlie said, "I have a mobile fingerprint scanner. Her finger pads are cracked open. It'll be hard to get a print."
"We can still try, but we'll have to go upstairs to get a signal."
"She's in full rigor." Will looked at the woman's face again. It was like trying to read a book. He could see pieces, but not the whole. The eyelashes were clumped together. The lip was torn apart. The jaw was set, roped like a cable on a suspension bridge. Rigor mortis. The coagulation of muscle proteins. It started in the eyelids, neck, jaw. All the muscles of the body stiffened, fixing the corpse in place. Faith asked,
"That means she's been dead for 3 to 4 hours?
"Longer," Sarah said, but she didn't say how much longer. Amanda asked,
"How do we get fingerprints when her hands are curled?"
"You'll have to break the fingers."
"Would it be easier if she were on her back?"
"I'll need help turning her." Will walked away from them to the other side of the room. The elderly man was lying on the gurney. Will tried to figure out the machines. Yellow fluid lurched around inside the canister. An orange tube came out of the bottom. There was some kind of pump working. He heard the motor turning, the shh of a bellow moving air. One liquid being pushed out, another liquid being pushed in. He followed the tube to the man's carotid. The liquid passed through a heavy gauge needle. There was another tube dropped over the side of the table, resting on the rusted edge of a floor drain. Snap. Like a twig being broken. Snap. Will kept his back to them. He didn't want to know who broke open the fingers. Snap.
"Okay," Charlie said. "I think that's good."
"Her fingers are a mess," Sarah said. "I don't think the scanner will be able to pick up the ridges."
"Try,"
Amanda told them. There was a rustling sound, a click, 3 rapid beeps, the mobile fingerprint scanner. Biometrics. There was an injection-molded dock with a 30-pin iPhone connector. The dock had a silver pad. The pad scanned the fingerprint. An app on the phone processed the scan into a 256-bit grayscale, 508 DPI image, then transmitted the data to the GBI's live scan servers, where the print was compared against the hundreds of thousands of prints stored in the system. The only thing required was the dock and a phone with a signal. Charlie was holding both in his hands as he walked toward the vestibule. He told Will,
"It's iffy because of the damage, but we might be able to get a hit."
Will didn't know why this information was directed specifically to him. He looked at his watch. Violent crimes tended to peak around 10 p.m. The servers would be processing thousands of requests. Even on a slow day, the results could take anywhere from 5 minutes to 24 hours. And then the GBI required that the prints had to be peer-reviewed by a group of human beings who could reach a consensus on whether or not the computer match met the threshold for a legal level of certainty. Faith said, "Sarah." Something about her tone of voice made Will turn around. Faith was standing at the foot of the gurney. She was looking down. The dead woman's feet were raised off the table, frozen by rigor mortis. Her hands between her knees had opened her legs, and her open legs gave a clear view of what was between them. Rape, Will thought. The woman who could not be Angie had not just been strangled and beaten and stabbed. Sarah was going to tell him that she had been raped. Will, Sarah waited for him to look at her. Did Angie ever have a child? He couldn't understand the question. Sarah said, "She has an episiotomy scar." Will had never heard the word before. "From an assault?" "From having a baby." He shook his head. Angie had been pregnant before, but not by Will. "She had an abortion 8 years ago." Faith said, "That's not how you get the scar." Sarah said, "It's a surgical incision made in the perineum during a vaginal birth." Faith translated, "They cut you open down there so the baby can come out." Will still didn't understand. It was like looking at the dead woman's face. He recognized the words, but not the sense. Sarah asked, "Does your chest feel tight?" Will looked down. He was rubbing his chest again. Faith said, "He wasn't feeling well before." "You're wrong," Will said. "I don't think it's her." Sarah was pushing him backward. The double doors opened. They stuttered closed. They were in the vestibule. Will was sitting at the metal desk. All three of them were hovering over him like in his worst kind of nightmare. Sarah said, "Take some deep breaths for me." Amanda said, "I have some Xanax." There was an enamel pill case in her hand. Pink base, roses on the lid. It was the sort of thing an old lady would use for her sniffing salts. Sarah said, "Put this under your tongue." Will complied without even thinking. The pill tasted bitter. He could feel it melting under his tongue. Saliva filled his mouth. He had to swallow. "It'll take a few minutes." Sarah started rubbing his back like he was a kid at the hospital. Will didn't like it. He hated being fussed over. He leaned over, putting his head between his knees, pretending like he was dizzy. Sarah rubbed his back some more. He palmed the pill. "Just breathe." Sarah's fingers went to his wrist. She was taking his pulse. "You're okay." Will sat up. Sarah was watching his every move. Amanda still held the open pill case in her hand. Faith had disappeared. Sarah asked, "Okay?"
"I don't think it's her."
Will repeated, but if anything, saying the words a second time made him question whether or not they were true.
"She never had a baby."
"She did,"
Amanda said. Will watched her mouth move. Her lipstick was smudged.
27 years ago, Angie disappeared from her foster placement. 3 months later, she showed up at the hospital. She was in labor. She delivered a girl. She left before social services could arrive.
The news should have hit him like a lightning strike, but nothing about Angie could surprise him anymore. Sarah asked, "How old was she?"
16.
1989. Will was stuck at the children's home. No one wanted a teenage boy around, especially one who was taller than all of his teachers. Angie was living with a couple who took in kids for a living. They had anywhere from 8 to 15 kids at a time, stacked into bunk beds, 4 to a room. Will asked Amanda, "How did you find out about this?"
"The same way I find out about everything."
Amanda's voice was hard. They never talked about the fact that she had followed Will from infancy, that throughout his life she had been the invisible hand that had redirected him whenever he got off course. Had she corrected Angie, too, steering her away from Will? He asked,
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. Amanda dropped the pill case back into her pocket. Angie disappeared. She abandoned her child. None of this should surprise you.
Sarah asked, did the baby survive?
Yes. I never found out what happened to her. She was lost in the system.
Their marriage application. Angie had filled out the form. They were sitting outside the probate office. The sunflower ring was already on her finger. Angie had read the questions aloud.
Over the age of 16? Sure. Ever been married before? Not that you know of. Father's name? Who the fuck knows? Mother's name? Doesn't matter. Related to the intended spouse? Uh-oh.
Her pen scratched the paper as she scribbled in the answers.
Children. Not me, baby.
She had laughed her deep, husky laugh.
Not that I know of, anyway.
Amanda said, the daughter was born in January. She would be 27 now. Delilah Palmer is 22. Sarah cleared her throat.
Do you know who the father is?
Amanda said, it's not Will.
Will wondered if that was true. That time in the basement. They hadn't used a condom. Angie wasn't on the pill. Then again, Will wasn't the only boy she took into the basement. Sarah's fingers were on his wrist again.
Your pulse is still thready.
Will pulled away his hand. He stood up. He looked at the closed double doors. He did not need to see the body again to know the truth. The sunflower ring, the car, the blood. Her ring. Her car, her blood. Her baby. Angie would abandon a baby. For some inexplicable reason, Will accepted this as proof above everything else. Angie did not have the capacity or the desire to care for something every single day for the rest of her life. Self-survival, not empathy, had always been her guiding principle. Will had seen it last Saturday, and he could easily see it happening 27 years ago. Angie went to the hospital. She'd had the baby. She'd left as soon as possible. And now she was dead.
Will asked Sarah, can we go home?
Yes. She put her keys in his hand. Go wait for me in the car. I'll be right there.
Amanda worked her BlackBerry. I'll tell Faith to wait with him.
Will understood that a conversation was going to take place between Sarah and Amanda, and that he would be the subject, but he didn't have the wherewithal to fight it. His chest was still caught in a vice. There was a rock inside his stomach. He climbed the stairs. He shoved his hand in his pocket to wipe it clean. What was left of the pill had melted into chalk. Some of the Xanax had gotten into his system. He was dizzy by the time he reached the end of the hall. His mouth tasted gritty. He tried three doors before he found the chapel. The lights were off, but between the large windows and the downtown glow, the rows of pews were easy to see. He looked up at the arched ceiling. Huge chandeliers hung down like jewelry. Gray carpet lined the aisle between the pews. The stage was flat, a lectern to the side. He guessed it was as non-denominational as a chapel could be. Will had been to church twice with Sarah, once at Easter and once on Christmas Eve. She wasn't religious, but she loved the pageantry. Will could still recall his surprise when she sang along with the congregation. She knew all the words by heart. Angie despised religion. She was one of those arrogant assholes who thought all believers were mentally deranged. She had been driven here in the trunk of her car. She had been carried down to the freezer. Her wedding ring was still on her finger. Had she been alive when the ring was put on? Had she asked the person with her to make sure that she wore it even in death? Will felt a burning sensation in his chest. He was rubbing his skin raw. What were the symptoms of a panic attack? He didn't want to ask Sarah because she would probably shove another pill in his mouth. Why had she done that? She knew he hated anything stronger than aspirin. He hated it even more that she had seen him upset. He acted like a pathetic kid. She would probably never want to have sex with him again. Will sat down on the steps to the stage. He fished his phone out of his back pocket. Instead of Googling panic attacks, he lay back on the carpet. He looked up at the crystals sparkling in the chandelier. The weight started to lift off his chest. His lungs filled with air. He was floating. This was the Xanax. Will didn't like it. Nothing good ever came out of losing control. Delilah Palmer. She could have been at Rippy's club when Harding died. She could have tried to save Angie. She could have driven Angie's body here. She could have called in the false alarm to get Bel Camino to leave, then watched him work the security panel at the elevator. One trip down to the basement, another trip back up. She leaves Angie's car here. She walks to her rental car and never looks back. Will's eyes would not stay open. He realized his head was where the casket would go during a funeral service. He would have to plan Angie's funeral. It would be easier to have it here. She would want to be cremated. Bel Camino could take care of that. Put it on his form. Process her for the crematorium. Who would come to the funeral? Amanda and Faith, because they would feel obligated. Sarah? He couldn't ask her. But she would probably volunteer. What about her mother and father? They were good country people. Kathy would probably bake a casserole. Or would she? Will knew that Sarah's mother didn't trust him. She wasn't wrong. He hadn't told Sarah about Saturday. He hadn't told her about a lot of things. Cops would come to the funeral. That's what you did when another cop died, no matter whether or not that cop was a good cop or a bad cop or retired. Lovers would attend, plenty of those. Old friends, not so much. Enemies, maybe. The father of her child. Maybe her child. 27 years old, angry, abandoned, wanting answers that Will could not give. He felt his eyelids relax. His face, his shoulders. An eerie silence settled in. He was in a quiet chapel. It was the middle of the night. Angie was dead. This is when he should feel it. The overwhelming loss, the hollowness that Sarah had described. She had been so angry at him for not being more devastated. Maybe something had broken inside of him. Maybe that was Angie's last piece of vengeance. She had turned off the thing inside of Will that was capable of feeling. His phone buzzed in his hand. Faith was probably looking for him. He answered, "I'm in the chapel." "Really?" "Not Faith. Another woman." Her voice low and cool. Will looked at the screen. The caller ID was blocked. "Who is this?" "It's me, baby." Angie gave her deep, husky laugh. "Did you miss me?" 1 week earlier. Monday, 7:22 p.m. Angie Pulaski stood up from her desk. She closed her office door. Muffled voices bled through, some asshole agent bragging to another asshole agent about money. Her hand stayed wrapped around the doorknob, strangling it. She hated this place with its stupid rich kids. She hated the perfect secretaries. She hated the pictures on the wall. She hated the athletes who'd built this place. She could go blind, listing all the things she hated. She sat back down at her desk. She stared at the screen on her laptop, feeling like actual fire was coming out of her eyes. If the damn computer hadn't cost so much, she would have thrown it on the floor and crushed it with her heel. "She's got his past. I've got him." Angie checked the date on the email that Sarah had written to her sister. 8 months ago. By Angie's calculation, Sarah had been screwing Will for only 4 months when she wrote the words. Pretty arrogant for her to think that Will was hers for the taking. Angie arrowed up to reread the paragraph. I never thought I could feel this way about another man again. Sarah sounded less like a doctor and more like a stupid teenage girl. It seemed appropriate. Sarah Linton was the exact kind of simpering, clueless girl you'd find at the center of a kid's novel. The one who stared moodily out the rain-streaked window and couldn't decide whether or not to date the vampire or the werewolf. Meanwhile, the so-called bad girl, the girl who was fun at parties, the one who would give you the best fuck of your life, was relegated to the corner, bound to end up seeing the error of her bad girl ways just before taking a stake to the heart. I've got him. Angie slammed the laptop closed. She shouldn't have cloned Sarah's laptop. Not because it was wrong, fuck that, but because it was torture reading the slow process of Sarah falling in love with Will. There were literally hundreds of emails from the last year and a half. Sarah wrote to her younger sister 4 or 5 times a week. Tessa wrote back just as often. They talked about their lives in mind-numbing detail. They complained about their mother. They joked about their absent-minded father. Tessa gossiped about the people living in Dirt Town or wherever the hell she was a missionary. Sarah talked about her patients at the hospital and new outfits she had bought for Will and how she had tried a new perfume for Will and that she had to get a doctor friend to write her a prescription because of Will. If not for anything else, Angie despised Sarah because she'd made her have to Google the words honeymoon cystitis. Angie hadn't been able to stomach the gooey, love-struck bullshit for long. She had skimmed ahead through the emails, looking for clues that the new car smell was wearing off. Will was far from perfect. He had a habit of picking up everything you put down, putting it away before you were finished using it. He had to immediately fix anything that was broken, no matter what time of day it was. He flossed his teeth too much. He would leave one sheet of toilet paper on the roll because he was too cheap to waste it. Had the most perfect night last night, Sarah had written last month. My God, that man. Angie stood up from her chair. She went to the window. She looked down at Peachtree. Evening rush hour. Cars were shuffling along the clogged roadway. She felt a pain in her hands. She looked down. Her fingernails were digging into her palms. Was this what it felt like to be jealous? Angie hadn't expected Sarah to stick around. Women like that didn't like messy things. And Angie had repeatedly made it clear that Will's life was messy. What she hadn't anticipated was that Will would fight for Sarah to stay. Angie had assumed the other woman was a trifle, something Will had been coerced into trying but would never enjoy, like the time Angie had talked him into buying a pair of sandals. Then she had seen them together at Home Depot. It was early spring, so maybe 5 months ago. Angie was at the store buying light bulbs. Will and Sarah had walked through the entrance, so up each other's butts that they hadn't seen Angie standing 5 feet away. They were holding hands, swinging their arms back and forth in a wide arc. Angie had followed them to the gardening section. She had stood in the adjacent aisle listening to them talk about mulch, because that's how tedious their lives were. Sarah had offered to get a shopping cart. Will had picked up the bag and thrown it onto his shoulder. "Babe," Sarah had said, "look at how strong you are." Angie waited for Will to tell her to get the fuck out, but he hadn't. He had laughed. He had hooked his arm around her waist. Sarah had nuzzled his neck like a dog. They had shuffled off to look at flowers, and Angie had broken every single light bulb she had in her basket. "Pulaski." Dale Harding stood in the doorway. His suit was wrinkled, the buttons of his shirt strained around his gut. She felt the usual disgust she always felt around Dale, not because of his weight or his sloppiness or that he had sold his own daughter to feed his gambling habit, but because Angie could never hate him as much as she wanted to. He said, "Party's about to start."
Your eyes are yellow. He shrugged.
It's what happens.
Dale was checking out. They both knew this. They didn't talk about it. How's Dee?
She's all right. Out of the closet.
They both smirked at the double meaning. Delilah had busted out of her last rehab facility, so Dale had decided the quickest way to dry her out was to lock her in his closet. He said,
I got a line on a doc who'll give her a legit script for the Suboxone.
Good, Angie said. The maintenance drug was the only thing that kept Delilah off of heroin. Because of government regulations, it was hard to come by. Angie had been scoring it through a dealer she didn't quite trust, banking on Dale dying soon so she could stop aiding and abetting his worthless junkie of a daughter. Wife, whatever. Did you talk to that lawyer?
Yeah, but I...
His answer was cut off by loud cheering. Champagne corks popped. Rap music pulsed through every speaker in the office. The party had started. They both knew that Kit Kilpatrick would be looking for them. Dale stepped aside so that Angie could go first. She smoothed down her skirt as she walked. Her high heels were killing her feet. But she would be damned if she wasn't going to go toe-to-toe with the young bitches in the office. They were all so clueless, their unlined faces and pouty lips contorting into confusion when Angie had to lean over the sink in the bathroom so she could get close enough to the mirror to reapply her eyeliner. There was no joy in telling them they were going to be 43 someday, because when that day came, she would already be in a nursing home. Or dead. Maybe Dale had it right. Much easier to go out on your own terms. He probably would have done it a lot sooner if not for his worthless daughter. There was something to be said about living child-free.
There's my girl.
Kip Kilpatrick was standing at the top of the floating glass staircase. As usual, he had a basketball in his hands. The guy couldn't go anywhere without the damn thing. He said,
I need you after this. My office.
We'll see. Angie brushed past him. She checked the room, looking for a familiar face. None of the big names had arrived yet. It was mostly 20-somethings in skinny suits drinking Cristal like it was water. She saw a large-scale architectural model underneath the LED sign. This was what the party was all about. The last pieces of the All-Star deal had finally come together. They were going to break ground in exactly 2 weeks. Angie looked down at the glass-enclosed model. Converted warehouses. Open-air shopping. Grocery store, movie theater, farmer's market, chic restaurants. Marcus Rippey's abandoned nightclub. Abandoned no more. The team would go in a week from now to spiff the place up. The club anchored the All-Star Complex, an almost $3 billion venture that all the agency's big stars had invested in. And some of the little stars, too. Kilpatrick was in for $10 million. Two other agents had invested half that.
Then there was the team of lawyers, an international cavalcade of leeches who, as far as Angie could see, were worth every freaking dime.
Will had tried to crack the lawyers a month ago and come out the loser. Angie had been rooting for him. She really had been. He had faced them all across the weirdly large conference table, doing his best to get any kind of answer. Marcus and LaDonna Rippey were almost secondary. Every time Will opened his mouth, Marcus looked at the lawyers, and the lawyers spun the answer into a kind of beautiful gibberish that only a Martian or a politician could understand. Angie had watched the entire thing from her office one floor down. Will had no idea that everything in the conference room was recorded. He sure as shit didn't know she was close by. On her screen, she could see him looking more and more frustrated as the lawyers threw out more and more obstacles. All Angie could do was shake her head. Poor thing. He was asking Marcus questions when he should have been talking to LaDonna.
Hey, doll.
Laszlo was leaning against a desk. A flute of champagne was in his hand. He was wearing his usual tight black pants and shirt. The look wasn't bad. He had a fantastic body. And a bitchy nose for fashion. He glanced down at her shoes.
How much?
50, she said, annoyed that he had noticed they were knockoffs. Thanks to her job,
She finally had enough cash in the bank to buy the real thing, but they weren't as comfortable as the fakes, and her back could only take so much standing around before it started to spasm.